This is December 3rd, 2017, and I'm going to plunge into the matter of sexual harassment and abuse and so forth, this upsurge that has been all over the news in recent weeks. If I'd had one more Teisho before Jukai, I would have done this in terms of the fourth precept or the third precept, not to misuse sexuality. But there's no reason we have to limit discussion of precepts to the weeks running up to Jukai once a year. The precepts is just a matter of conduct, how we conduct ourselves in our lives. That's a year-round challenge for us. And this is such a huge thing that's happening now ever since, starting with Harvey Weinstein. And I feel such a hopeful, such a exciting kind of reckoning and a healthy thing that's happening that I feel I can't resist talking about. It is a complex issue. I mean, on the face of it, most of these cases are pretty simple, just matters of violations. But when you get underneath the surface of it, there's more to talk about. So I'm going to rush in where angels fear to tread and see if I can offer one person's understanding of the complexity of this. I scribbled notes this morning, a page of notes that aren't in any particular order, so forgive me if it's a bit I'm a little bit disorganized in presenting these things. So it's really a matter of right action. Right action is one of the one eighth of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the Noble Eightfold Path is the fourth of the four noble truths. That is how we can get free of suffering, unnecessary suffering. And that's often been called right action, right conduct versus misconduct. What we're seeing here is a cultural upheaval, I believe, that is an extension, an outgrowth of what we've been seeing since the inauguration, but even before that in the campaign. There are massive things in motion now. I saw a certain actor and comedian, John Leguizamo, who likened this past year and a half under Trump and under the influence of Trump as a kind of an enema, where all this shit is coming out. The alt-right, the racism, and this is just a continuation of it. Is the sexual abuse and so forth that is starting to be known, that I suppose probably has always happened. I think I have to say, broadly speaking, I'm very sympathetic to the women's side of this. I probably have been ever since my sisters would come home as they were in high school. They had a summer job at a local golf course and would come in and just speak and with no details, just disgust at the way the men, when they came off the course and they were throwing down alcohol, what they would be subjected to. But it's a complex thing, really. Any precept, if you dig down into it far enough, it's complex. First of all, there is a range of transgressions among these celebrities we've been hearing about, and I'm going to talk in specific in particular people, because it takes it out of the abstract, and I think you have to, because it matters. Yasutani Roshi said decades ago that in any of the precepts, there are four considerations: time, place, position, and degree. It is a very insightful way to look into any precept or potential violation of the precepts. Time, by time, I'm sure he meant the era, what it would be acceptable in the 1950s or the 1850s would not necessarily be acceptable now. Place is important. Different contexts, workplace, home, bars, whatever. Position is vitally important to this discussion. It's position of power or equality, equality or disparity of power. And degree is what we've seen, quite a range of degrees of accusations. I would say that from what I've heard, and you can't, if you listen to the news, you can't miss this stuff. I would say that of the ones I've heard, I don't think I've heard of all of them, Garrison Keillor is the one that seems on the mild end of it. If he's to be believed, and that's what's so hard about this, is we don't know. We weren't there. We have to believe one side or the other, or at least partially believe one side or other. But if what he says is true, he placed his hand on the back of a woman who was distraught. He said, as a way of soothing her, reassuring her, and by mistake hit some bare skin on her back, and he thought everything was okay, that he apologized, he said, and until he heard from her lawyers. Then you go from there to, I think, Al Franken, because he's a comedian, he was a comedian, and sort of spawned in the Saturday Night Live culture of sophomoric, sort of stupid, kind of off-color jokes, that he maybe is less reprehensible what he did. That photo of him clowning around, in his mind, clowning around, and he actually did send the photo around, so he must have thought it was pretty innocent, clowning around with that reporter who was apparently sleeping with her helmet on when they are on a USO tour in Iraq or Afghanistan, somewhere there. It's not clear that he's actually touching her. He's mugging, looking back at the camera. That's, I guess, one of the unintended effects of this kind of low-grade humor, is that it becomes normalized. It seems to have become normalized to him. I'm not taking the side of any of these guys. I just need to point out that there are differences of degrees of culpability or obnoxiousness. And then Louis C.K., even his victims didn't claim that he touched them. It was just this kind of sick masturbating in front of them. And then, what is that? Would someone tell me what the deal is with that? I don't remember this when I was younger, about this. In private, yes, but to women in front of them without touching them? And then we move up to more obvious position of power, Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose getting more gross. And then, of course, Harvey Weinstein and the ultimate, it's really off the charts, is Roy Moore with his child, involvement with children. So, yes, there are differences. And here's another thing to complicate all this, is true, we don't know for sure what happened, but when we get an admission and an apology, then that's pretty close to knowing. Not absolutely, because sometimes, there's this great story of Hakuin's teacher being confronted. Hakuin was 18th century Japanese Zen master. Hakuin's teacher being confronted by a pregnant girl in the village with her parents. She claimed that he had made her pregnant, and he hadn't, apparently, according to the story, he hadn't, but he didn't argue. He just said, "Is that so? Sodiska, is that so?" And according to the story, who knows whether how true this is, but he actually accepted the baby and raised it for the first year of its life, no doubt with help, a lot of help from women. And then after a year, the parents came back scraping and groveling with apologies because the girl, their daughter, had confessed that it wasn't Hakuin's teacher. And he handed the baby back and said, "Is that so?" Now this is such an exalted state of transcendence of right and wrong. We can't expect that any of these guys in the news would have reached that state. But we really don't know for sure. Anyone who thinks they know what happened, unless there's an apology and a full admission of guilt, is just filling in what they don't know. Let's always keep that in mind, grabbing at things that we hear in the news that we can't possibly know. And then there's the matter of the central doctrine in Buddhism of dependent co-arising, in which there no thing arises in and of itself. No thing is apart from every other thing. I've often used the example of teacher and student, the progress, that the student's progress is not just a matter of the abilities of the teacher or the abilities of the student, but it's that teacher with that student at that time. Same, of course, in any academic teachers, with physicians, psychotherapists, it's the joining, the co-arising of the event. And that means that we can't look at just the man. That there can be factors involved with the women. We know from what the women say some of these cases, they say that they didn't say anything at the time because they felt it would jeopardize their career. Well, that's a factor. Doesn't excuse it in the least, but it's a factor. If you're ambitious enough to not want to risk your career, then that's something to not ignore. There's the health, the mental health of the woman is a factor. It is the background. It's the life experiences of the woman are another factor that can play out there. The backstory. But And we know that there have been cases in the history of men and women where women have falsely accused men. I personally can't believe there are that many, but there are some. It happens in spiritual centers, Zen centers, Tibetan Buddhist centers, where a woman who's not quite together makes claims that prove not to be true. But I think these are the exceptions. You know, the borderline personalities who maybe make a play for the therapist or the teacher or the boss and are rebuffed, and then with vindictiveness lodge these claims. I think they're very rare. How would I know? But I suppose they are. It doesn't seem to me that most women would lodge these complaints, especially under the glare of TV and radio and all, that they would do that falsely. There's that old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think just common sense tells us that when enough women lodge these complaints about the same man, yeah, come on. There was I was recently talking with a man who wasn't in our sangha, but he was getting rather angry about his suspicions about some of these reports, about why didn't the woman do this or do that or say this or say that. And I ran across an article in the New York Times, I think is, I'm just going to skip through a few points of it. It was last week. It's titled, "She Didn't Fight Back: Five Misguided Reasons People Doubt Sexual Misconduct Victims." And this is written by Shayla Dewan. And just to hit the main points here, these are the five. The victim doesn't act like one. And then, among other points, she says, there is no one response to sexual assault. A trauma victim can as easily appear calm or flat as distraught or overtly angry. Later, they may react by self-medicating, by engaging in high-risk sexual behavior, by withdrawing from those around them, or by attempting to regain control. Some child victims initiate sexual abuse, experts say, just so they can predict when it is coming. Second point, those who are suspicious, she stayed friendly with her abuser. And it's been an education to really read articles about this. She stayed friendly with her abuser. Offenders work assiduously to gain trust and appear benevolent, and that relationship does not disappear overnight, even after an abusive episode. Women in particular, experts point out, are conditioned to smooth things over. Victims think that it was their fault. This is a Boston lawyer who has represented hundreds of victims of abuse by Catholic priests and school teachers. His name is Roderick McLeish. Victims think it was their fault, so in many cases they want continued contact. And then later they realize that it was for the perpetrator's sexual gratification, and that's devastating. Another point there under that one, the victim may have little choice but to stay in contact if the offender is a boss, teacher, coach, or relative. The third accusation is she did not come forward right away. The point this author makes is when the experts point to a more fundamental issue. When the perpetrator is someone they trusted, It can take years for victims even to identify what happened to them as a violation. And she says that the offenders she treats list two main tactics they use to obscure assaults. They camouflage the act as horseplay or humor, or they act as though nothing happened. Fourth accusation, her story does not add up. And it says, not only does memory fade with time, but when the brain's fear circuitry is activated, the prefrontal cortex, where details like sequence and locations are recorded, tends to recede, while the part of the brain that records sensory memories kicks in. Victims may vividly remember a wallpaper pattern or a scent, but not the order of events. And then the fifth accusation, she didn't fight back. The author says, when people are mugged or robbed, they are not asked why they did not resist. But in sexual assault cases, failure to resist can be one of the biggest sticking points for jurors. Often both sides acknowledge that a sex act occurred, and the question is whether it was consensual. Fighting back is viewed as an easy litmus test, but women are conditioned not to use violence. Men and women both tend to compare a victim's actions with what they think they themselves would have done in a similar situation, and research shows that their imagined response usually involves aggressive resistance, even when the attacker is larger and stronger. And then this woman says, quotes someone as saying, in their heads, suddenly they know kung fu. And then it says neurobiological research has shown that the so-called fight or flight response to danger would more accurately be called fight, flight, or freeze. And even after that initial response, victims can be rendered involuntarily immobile, becoming either paralyzed or limp as a result of the brain and body's protective response. I've heard people express shock at reports of some of these reports, particular Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose. I wasn't shocked myself because for two reasons. First, they're men, and second, they're men in power. I've read in Teicho's years ago from a book called a book by Helen Fisher, an anthropologist who's written extensively about monogamy, sexuality, marriage, infidelity, and as an anthropologist, she takes a very basic view of male female conditioning, wiring, that we have these. We are animals in one sense. In one sense, we are animals. We have these biological imperatives. Some have described it as sex and aggression. Boom, there, sex and aggression. That's the hardwiring. Let's just talk about men. The hardwiring of men is sex and aggression. But of course, that's just part of it. The other is how we work with that, how we integrate our sex drive with interpersonal relationships, which at their best, sex is sharing, not inflicting And sexuality has a range from healthy responses in the right, with the right people at the right time in the right place in the right relationship, healthy responses to disturbed or perverse responses. But a big factor that we've seen in these things is men in positions of power. And that's what where the problems really come in. And part of my reading for this Teisho, I was reading from psychologists and others, one of whom said that people in positions of power became powerful by avoiding introspection, by believing that what they do is right, to reach the summit of business or politics. They argue you can't be tortured by guilt or indifference, so you blot out what isn't right. This is compartmentalizing or splitting, that some people have a striking capacity to split. And these guys have a sense of entitlement that blinds them to the consequences of their actions. The longer you're in a position of power over others, in business or spirituality or politics, anything, the longer you're in that position, and the greater the position of power, the accumulation of power, the more, I guess, we tend to be blinded to the consequences of our actions. The literature also shows that ambitious politicians are invigorated by risk, and they feel impervious to the consequences. One psychologist at Temple University, a Dr. Frank Farley, wrote that many of these politicians are type T personalities, T standing for thrill. This is what he wrote about politicians. You're at the whim of the electorate. It's all or nothing. Win or lose. You don't have tenure. So it inspires a risk-taking person to go into that line of work. But on the public side, they're supposed to show stability and responsibility. And then this risky side, risk-taking side, shows itself more on the private side. The danger always in these situations, especially when it's so long in coming, this correction of power between the sexes, it's so long in coming, is to just decide that men are bad and women are good. I'm guessing that few people hearing this talk would think in such clumsy black and white terms. If you do, then you're denying the fact that to be human means to be laced with greed, anger, and delusion. All of us, to some degree or another. I guess until, you know, according to the party line, until full enlightenment, we all have degrees of greed, anger, hostility, and delusion. So that's another thing to factor in when considering the degree of responsibility by the man and the woman. I was talking with a woman who reported when she was, you know, these events of the last few weeks have just brought up memories from many of us, actually. And this woman was saying when she was like 17, she worked at a clothing, men's clothing store in New York, and the boss's son asked her out. So she went out with him, and then he invited her up to his apartment, and she still marvels at how naive she was. Well, she was 17, but she went up with him, and he came on to her, and she said that she shut him down, and he was willing to just take her home, let it go at that. But I bet a lot of people hearing this talk have had, especially the women, have had similar experiences where they either are relieved at how they reacted or regret how they reacted. If those women who've written articles that seem to me not quite the middle way, where they're more angry and willing to just put all the blame on the man, my feeling is, all right, cut him some slack. It's been centuries, millenniums of oppression by men over women. One woman, a New York Times columnist by the name of Lindy West, she wrote an article called "Brave Enough to Be Angry." This is what she wrote, and I think this is very, very correct. She said, "Not only are we expected to weather sexual violence, intimate partner violence, workplace discrimination, institutional subordination, the expectation of free domestic labor, the blame for our own victimization, and all the subtler, invisible cuts that undermine us daily, we are not even allowed to be angry about it. We are expected to keep quiet about the men who prey on us, as though their predation was our choice, not theirs. We are expected to sit quietly as men debate whether or not the state should be allowed to forcibly use our bodies as incubators. We are expected not to complain as we are diminished, degraded, and discredited." I always think of the metaphor of the pendulum. I think the pendulum has been out one side for so long. It's really wonderful to think that maybe it's finally starting to swing back in the other way. And in this kind of transition period, let's allow women to react. Another article I want to share with you is by an Amber Tamblyn. She's an actress, writer, and director. And the title she writes is "I'm Not Ready for the Redemption of Men." And just to hit some of the main points of it, she was in a heated discussion with certain man and woman, and the man is starting to get frustrated about where to draw the line, where we can be safe from approaching women. And he said, "Tell me something, do you believe in redemption?" And this is what she wrote: "It's a valid question, but it's also a question that makes me deeply suspicious of its timing. Why do we need to talk about the redemption of men when we are right in the middle of the salvation of women? Not even the middle, but the very beginning. Why are we obligated to care about salvaging male careers when we have just begun to tell the stories that have plagued us for lifetimes. It seems some men like a revolution only when it's their kind of war. And that's my hope, is that we're seeing a real revolution here. You know, the morning after the election last November, I posted this famous story from ancient China about when misfortune happens. I won't repeat it because I've recounted it so many times. But when misfortune strikes, to question, you know, who's to say this isn't a blessing? Well, the women victims can say it's not a blessing, but stepping back and looking more broadly, this is a very exciting time. She says, these guys who want to talk about redemption and they want a sense of normalcy restored, she says they want measured discussion of consequences, not swift punishment. They want us to leave poor Al Franken and his harmless grabbing alone. I've heard several male friends talk about text chains they are on with other men only. They describe it as a safe space to talk about how they feel in this moment. They feel afraid, disoriented, and discounted. And I understand their need for such comfort and security. I am a woman. I know nothing other than needing such comfort and security for my entire life. We're in the midst of a reckoning, she says. It's what toxic masculinity's own medicine tastes like. And people should allow the consequences to unfold, regardless of how it affects those they consider to be friends. The only way to enforce seismic cultural change in the way men relate to women is to draw a line deep in the sand and say, this is what we will no longer tolerate. You're either with our bodies or against our bodies. The punishment for harassment is you disappear. The punishment for rape is you disappear. The punishment for masturbation in front of us is you disappear. The punishment for coercion is you disappear. And then this fellow she was talking with says, look, do I believe Louis C.K. is going to come back in a year or so with a lot of reflection about what he did? Yes, I do. When he goes back out on that stand-up tour someday, I'll roll my eyes and say, all right, get on with it then. But for now, his old power is over. He's going to have to find a new power if he ever wants to come back. A new power, she writes. Can there be one for men free of humiliation, shame, and violent assault against women? What would it take to achieve it? That's the question for men and their text chains right now, not the question of how soon they can ask about redemption. Redemption must be preceded by atonement. It is earned, not offered. If you want amends, you have to make them. You have to acknowledge the line in the sand. Once you do this, the next step is simple. Pick a side. Choose us. By which, I take it to mean choose a healthy relationship, not one of oppression. That goes back to, that atonement goes back to, well, we hit on a couple of Teishos recently about the forces of purification and repentance, genuine repentance, and somehow making it up, trying to make it up to the woman. back to our basest impulses, our most primitive impulses. We're not gonna get rid of those for maybe a few thousand more years. So we have to learn how to work with them. And the first thing is to recognize that they're going to come up. It's like anger. There it is again, sex and aggression. Anger arises. We don't have a choice as to whether or not we get angry. Most of you know that the wording of the ninth precept used to be, our version of it used to be, I resolve not to become angry. Well, that's impossible. We don't have a choice. Anger comes up. And so does sexual attraction. And then it's just a matter of how we deal with it. It starts with noticing. This just brings us right squarely back into the work that we do as a Sangha, is mindfulness, noticing when you're attracted to someone. That's also the first step with anger, noticing when the anger is arising in you. And that's what's so amazing, is that these powerful emotional responses can happen, and we actually aren't consciously aware of them, because we're so fixated on the object of the anger, the object of the sexual attraction. So noticing the signs, noticing the physiological signs that you're starting to get attracted to someone. And then, as a second mindfulness challenge, noticing the impulse to touch the person as a first step, or even before that, to flirt with the person. Noticing. It's only when we notice these initial responses that we have the freedom to choose what to do. And it'll always be just kind of a measure of freedom. I found myself going back to one of my all-time favorite books called The User Illusion. And the subtitle is Cutting Consciousness Down to Size. And it talks about how through careful research, through studies, laboratory studies, they find that that consciousness can't initiate an action, but it can decide that it should not be carried out. I'm reading here from the book. The author is Tor Nuratranders. He's a Norwegian science writer. I won't go into all of it. It isn't time. But it's a stunning evidence. It's really indisputable that we start responding before, without initiating it. There's something bigger acting in us, bigger than our conscious mind. Just to hit these high points here, the scientist who did these breakthrough studies, his name is Benjamin Libet. He said we can control our actions, but not our urges. And the author here says this is a very profound distinction. For there is a very great difference between a perception of morality that tells you what you may do and the one that tells you what you may have the urge to do. And then he goes on from there to distinguish between the Old Testament commandments and the New Testament commandments. In Judaism, he says, the commandment is, the golden rule is, do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. Whereas the Christian is, do unto others what you would want them to do to you. Which is a whole different thing. the point here is that we have veto power over our urges. This makes the wording of even the Buddhist precepts more understandable, as it begins with the negative: not to kill, not to take what is not given, not to misuse sexuality, and so forth. That we can't control the urges, the impulses. They have a mind of their own, anger, sex, but we do have the ability to veto them, to use his word, to say, no, I'm not going there. To my surprise, I think I've covered most of the main points I meant to, but I just want to wrap it up by emphasizing how important daily practice is to managing one's impulses and becoming aware of other people in their own right. Mindfulness, noticing. And then we have a choice. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to the root Dharma gate beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way